Florida's debacle on vaccine distribution, and remembering survivors of the Holocaust. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Floridians are struggling just to get their COVID vaccine appointment, and doses are running out fast. How could a new residency requirement shake things up? We're going to get the latest update. Also, today is Holocaust Remembrance Day. We'll listen back to our conversation with Holocaust survivor Anita Carl, and we'll hear the incredible story of how her mom rescued her and her sisters from the Nazis.
She's the symbol of our people. She saved 3 lives from the Holocaust.
Finally, a conversation with orchid collectors about this month's book club title, The Orchid Thief. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The COVID-19 vaccine rollout in Florida has been anything but smooth. Those currently eligible for vaccines include healthcare workers, long-term care facility residents and staff, and people 65 and older. But a new residency requirement and the process to make an appointment have created obstacles for those who might need the vaccine the most. WLRN's healthcare reporter Veronica Zaragovia joins us now. Veronica, great to have you back.
Thank you so much, Luis.
And by the way, we want to hear from you. Have you been able to get your vaccine appointment? Have you been able to make it? Or maybe you've been unsuccessful. Maybe you've helped someone finalize their appointment. We'd like to hear what it's been like for you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Veronica, what are the different ways that people can make an appointment? I actually don't know all of them.
You know, mostly it's by phone or using a website. And Governor Ron DeSantis said today that the state is going to expand a statewide vaccine registration system that uses a phone for those seniors, especially who don't have access to the internet. And some counties are using it. So in Broward, for instance, Broward County, there's a phone number you can use. Miami-Dade County has very recently also put out a phone number. And we have just to help our listeners, we have those on our website at WLRN.org. If you look for a story we have about making appointments, we have those numbers listed.
And for those in Miami-Dade, the time to make a telephone appointment appears to already have passed.
Thank you for calling the Miami-Dade County Vaccination Program. At this time, all first-dose vaccination appointments have been issued. For more information and updates, visit miamidade.gov/vaccine.
Gracias por llamar al programa de vacunación del condado de Miami-Dade.
So it seems that these appointments, Veronica, they get scooped up pretty fast.
Yes, it's within minutes, really, they get scooped up. Some of these for phone systems say that they will call you back. And because I'm not 65 or older, I haven't gone through the entire process to see if it's possible, if they actually do call back to set up an appointment. This one, obviously, if they're full, then there's no way to proceed.
And the state provided walk-up options for testing. Are there any options like that for vaccines?
Not right now. You do need to make an appointment. I do know of people who do drive up to some of these sites, and if they're lucky and they qualify, sometimes they don't quite have the right age, but they're still getting vaccinated. But I really would recommend that. I mean, all the officials are asking for people not to do that because it just causes a big backlog. It causes a big lines. And if you live within walking distance and you were able to make an appointment through, for instance, your church, there have been some opportunities through Black churches or through other houses of worship, then that might be considered more of a walk-up opportunity. Or when, you know, if you live within walking distance to a Publix, but you do still have to make appointments.
And, you know, thinking like when you go to some of these places, do they have, like when we had the testing, do they have that opportunity, for example, if you were in your car, that you'd stay in your car, you get the shot while you're in your car?
Right. So for the drive-up sites, you would stay in your car. You don't get out of the car. And sometimes in some sites, that does cause a very long line. So you need to get there with a full tank of gas, because I've been told about hours of waiting in the car.
I do remember getting a test in a car, and yeah, it took hours. How about people who don't have cars? I mean, what about people who have a hard time getting anywhere? Are there opportunities for the vaccine to come to you?
Yes, there are. And for instance, the city of Miami has been doing a lot of vaccinations at facilities that are like senior living facilities in the city where people live. And Miami-Dade County has done that as well, where they're doing vaccinations on the site. Some people, for instance, in Century Village, if you live at some of these retirement communities, they offer vaccinations on site so you don't have to drive anywhere. And part of the city of Miami's efforts is to reduce the vaccine tourism that we'll talk about. And they want to just get these vaccines in seniors' arms and not create opportunities for people to sign up who shouldn't.
Now, we talked about, again, how to stay up to date. And yes, they can go to our website and we try to keep everybody up to date on where to get these appointments, how to get these appointments. But it's still challenging for some people. My understanding is there's a Facebook group now to help people.
That's right. And in fact, that Facebook group, which is called South Florida COVID-19 Vaccination Info, it's expanding throughout the state. So there are, I have seen people post on there asking questions at counties outside of South Florida, and they're also training volunteers. So it's becoming a really big effort to help people who are really struggling. So you can either post on there if you know of appointments that will open up, or you can say, you know, my grandfather needs help. What do I do? And you can get help.
Yeah. Now, some hospitals and government officials are using social media. They're using Twitter to announce, you know, when vaccines are available. But again, not everybody has access to the internet. Not everybody's on Twitter. You know, what are they doing for people in those situations? How else are they trying to get that information out?
I think they're just asking people to use these phone numbers, and they're asking people to help, to reach out and help if you know of a, if you have a loved one or a friend who is 65 and older and qualifies to help out. And I think that's been the biggest criticism, that it's been so difficult for people who are not on Twitter all the time to figure out how to do it. There really isn't a direct answer to your question. People need to reach out for help.
You know, listening to your stories, your reporting, it's just, you hear the frustration people have trying to get an appointment. I mean, you've been hearing all kinds of really sad but interesting stories about the struggle. People just to get the appointment, just to get the first shot.
Yeah, exactly. I checked in with one source who's 78, who lives just north of Palm Beach County yesterday. I had spoken to her 3 weeks ago. She had gotten a tip from a friend who told her, oh, at this lab in Fort Pierce, they're offering vaccinations. So she drove an hour, but told me yesterday that her friends in that age group continue to feel at a loss on how to make an appointment. So if there was ever a time that somebody 65 and older was going to learn to use Twitter, this would be the time, because it is constantly having updates, but not everyone uses it.
And a lot of times you just need somebody in the family or friend to help you get there. Is there, every state is kind of doing it their own way. This is not a federal push. Every state has got their own system. When we look at other states compared to Florida, where is Florida? Are we good? Are we doing a good job? Or are other states doing way better than us?
Well, some of the states that are doing better, for instance, in West Virginia, rather than depending on the federal option that Florida took up to use CVS or Walgreens at the long-term care facilities, they've been going with independently owned pharmacies that were quicker to act, because there's a lot of bureaucracy with using CVS or Walgreens. There's a lot of paperwork. And so they have been pretty slow. And this is a problem not only in Florida, across the country. Then you have cities like Houston or Los Angeles using really big, for instance, in LA, they use Disneyland. In Houston, they use Minute Maid Park, where the Astros play. And then they involved the city's fire department and police. And so it was really efficient. And even though they ran out, as it's happening all over the state, it was done well, and they got a lot of praise for that.
I think I remember we were having a discussion the other day in a news meeting that there are people who think Amazon should take over the distribution because they're better at it.
Right. There is a lot of they're actually moving forward, states or at the federal level, to see how they can involve the private sector that has plenty of experience with efficiency and speed. Starbucks has been, you know, mentioned, and Amazon has offered its help. So that, I think it seems they're going to be moving in that direction to not just make it a government operation.
Again, I'm talking with WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. COVID-19 vaccines have been available in South Florida for over a month, but new requirements and the process to get an appointment have created obstacles for those who need the vaccine the most. For more of our reporting on COVID-19 vaccines and a guide on how you can make an appointment, find us on social media if you are there. It's at WLRN Sundial, or you can go to the website WLRN.org. And again, we want to hear from you, your challenges in trying to make an appointment. Maybe you have a question. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Post it there for us at WLRN Sundial. Another issue has been making sure that those receiving the vaccine actually live in Florida. And we've heard this phrase pop up, Veronica, vaccine tourism. You spoke with Steve Ullman. He's a professor and the director of the Center for Health Management and Policy at the University of Miami. Here's what he said.
There's also a cost of administering that vaccine. You require nurses. You require people who have a higher level of medical understanding when they're giving the vaccine. Those are costs that are incurred by somebody, either the healthcare system or the government. And that's why one of the major concerns is if people come in from outside the state, we are in turn bearing the cost in the state of Florida.
All right. So, Veronica, last week, Governor DeSantis on Fox and Friends said there's no vaccine tourism in Florida. Do we know if vaccine tourism is an issue?
Yeah, on the one hand, we've actually seen it, people on social media or in interviews admitting that they've flown here to get a vaccine or to get a parent vaccinated. And the Florida Department of Health puts out a daily report with information on how many people have gotten vaccinated in a 24-hour period. And the latest report has 49,700 people from out of state who've been vaccinated. That could include snowbirds who live here part of the year, and another 1,200 who are labeled as unknown. So even if the governor says it's not happening, I mean, there are people who apparently don't live in the state who are getting vaccinated,
and
quite a lot of them.
The governor said he has no problem with snowbirds.
That's right, because they usually have a residence here. They might live even up to 6 months here. They go see doctors. They pay, you know, taxes. And so he's mentioned they're fine.
So no, do we just to understand the difference between that and the vaccine tourism, snowbirds have a residency here. Maybe it's for a few weeks, maybe it's for a few months, but they do come here. They get mail here. They pay bills here. Where a tourist is just coming in for a little while, they have no residency here.
Exactly.
Yeah, to know the difference. Now, the day before the governor denied this vaccine tourism, State Surgeon General Scott Rifke signed a public health advisory saying that vaccine providers should ensure that recipients are Florida residents. How have hospitals and the vaccine providers responded to that?
You know, it's been similar to the way that everybody has a different system. Now, all of these different providers are reacting differently. Jackson Health System had pretty quickly issued a requirement for proof of U.S. residency. And right when this advisory came out, then they changed it to a Florida requirement. And then other providers, for instance, the city of Coral Springs announced on Friday that they're requiring proof of Florida residency. So now, on top of all the different problems of not knowing what each one, you know, how to sign up. Now you also have to see who's asking for what.
You also spoke with a Jodel Newman, a professor of clinical legal education at the University of Miami, about who is affected most by this residency requirement. Here's what he said.
We represent, for example, hundreds of Haitian clients who are TPS recipients and have legally resided in our community since the Haitian earthquake in 2010. Many of those individuals have serious health problems. They definitely need this vaccine more than anyone, but they would have very difficult time coming up with the kind of documentation that is being required by JHS right now.
So, Veronica, who is affected the most by this requirement?
You know, it will affect people. This is not just about undocumented immigrants, but people who we have homeless people in South Florida who will be affected because they don't have a property deed or a lease. There are people, asylum seekers and refugees, as she mentioned, other immigrants who are here with visas. And so the problem is that Jackson, which cares for a lot of people who struggle the most financially, has now put a barrier to their health care.
All right. How can the state separate tourists from those who live here, you know, and need the vaccine the most? What is it, simply looking at their driver's license, their ID, or is there some other process? And who's talking about doing this?
You know, people are not talking about this enough. It's more the critics like Professor Jonelle Newman who's saying, then if they want to weed out the tourists and, you know, require that they come with their return ticket and see how long they'll be staying here. And she says that the state, should be, all of these people who are here for the long term should be eligible to get a vaccine. And so we're not hearing very much discussion on what to do so that these people are not left out.
Yeah. I want to come back to Steve Oldman again from the University of Miami, because he had mentioned the consequences for this, again, on this requirement of residency. Let's take a listen.
Illness does not understand citizenship, residency. The illnesses are not that smart. And so as a result, they will move to people who do not have residency or citizenship in the United States or cannot document that, they are still not immune from this disease by any means. And so by having this kind of documentation that may not be available to every individual, you will find the situation that diseases will just move into those population groups.
So, Veronica, how are health officials dealing with this?
Yeah, I mean, this is a concern because we do have a sizable population around the country of undocumented immigrants. And Professor Eileen Marty, who's often on our programs helping us make sense of it all, has said that, you know, the virus is just looking for cells to invade. It's not asking for paperwork of whether you live here or not. So when you have a lot of people walking around who can't now get vaccinated because of another layer of administration, then it could cause, it could take longer for us to get to that 75-80% of immunity so that this virus stops spreading so much.
So let me finish with this. What can you tell us about how the state is doing with its vaccine supply? I mean, we had the White House claiming that Florida hasn't even used half of its supply. So where are we with our supply? When are we getting more?
Right. That started because first Governor DeSantis said he didn't want FEMA camps coming here, as he said that that's what President Biden had suggested. And so then the White House reacted by saying, well, you're holding about half of the supply. And so it seems that several weeks, Governor DeSantis has said at press conferences that shots need to go into arms and providers should not withhold any. But in a reversal on Tuesday, then he's admitted that the state is withholding vaccines to ensure seniors and healthcare workers can get their second doses. And I think it's a reaction to the reduced amount of doses that we've been getting in Florida and across the country. And they're saying, you know, it'll pick up again. They're promising that more vaccines will be coming. So at the moment, we have to see what happens next.
And again, we're still in just the first phase, which is 65 and older and certain people. And there's a lot of us waiting back here. We're not even sure when we're going to get to, our turn. But I want to thank WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. Veronica, thank you again for the insight.
Thank you, Louis. I appreciate it.
And again, follow her reporting on the website, WLRN.org. And again, as she mentioned, that's where you can also find out where to get tested and also where to, you know, sign up for the vaccine. Well, still to come, we're going to hear the story of Holocaust survivor Anita Carl and her passion to educate children about the history. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Anita Carl survived unthinkable circumstances. As a young Jewish girl in Poland, her family was among the very few that were able to escape a ghetto in her hometown at the start of World War II. Carl's family was able to escape through Peru and then eventually get to the United States. She's retired now and living in Aventura and continuing to share her story with young children in schools across South Florida. Carl believes the way to combat Holocaust denial is through education. Now, we saw the images of these new Nazis and denial groups on display at the U.S. Capitol just weeks ago. On this National Holocaust Remembrance Day, we bring you her story. She came to the studios back in April of 2018. Let's start with your story. You were very young when you were living in, and please help me with the name of the city you were living in.
It's Lwów.
Lwów, okay.
In Poland.
In Poland. Then the Nazis showed up.
The Nazis came in, invaded Poland in 1939, but came to our city, Lwów, in 1941. Immediately they settled a ghetto in a poor part of the city, and all the Jewish population was forced to go there.
How would you describe to people what the city of Lwów was like before the Nazis arrived?
Before the Nazis came, it was a very large cosmopolitan city, a very intellectual city. It had the opera house, theaters, schools, and many, many people who lived there were Jewish and others were not. The Jewish people lived comfortably among the Gentiles and for many years had no problems.
And as you said, they came in, they created a ghetto, and they forced the Jewish people to move to this ghetto.
Yes.
What now, you had a certain type of life, and then all of a sudden your family, you had to live in this ghetto. How do you describe what that was like? What was the ghetto like?
That was a very, very terrible times for us, because the life as I knew it disappeared suddenly. And I was forced to live in a place that was a man-made hell, where it was easier to die than to live.
And
people perished from hunger, from many diseases, and were murdered by the Nazis without any reason or provocation.
Were you with your entire family?
I was at the beginning with my entire family, which was a very large family. My mother was one of 10 and my father one of 6. And we were 3 sisters, 3 little girls. And we had hunger, we suffered from hunger, we suffered from the weather. In Poland, the winters are very, very cold, and it was simply difficult to live.
Now, at some point, your mother said, we have to get out of here.
When the law to murder all the children came, just before they were doing the transfers to the concentration camps, my mother said she would not stand by and watch her children being murdered. So she made a plan, and we escaped from the ghetto after 2 years of living in this inferno, in this hell. And against all odds, we escaped. We took off everything that would identify us as Jews. We took a train to the southern part of Poland, and my life as a Catholic girl began. My mother sought refuge in the church.
You said your mother had a plan. How did you guys get past the Nazis, the Nazi guards, and all, because you had to run into a lot of them?
This was in December. It was very, very cold. And the Nazis, although they looked on the perimeter of the ghetto, but at night, sometimes they fell asleep. And it was not expected of anyone to try this plan to try to escape, because people were afraid, people were cold and hungry. The Germans were armed, and they were well fed, and they were protected from the climate. But we were lucky. Somehow God was looking over us, And my mother was a very, very brave and courageous woman. And she gave us life again. And she escaped to life with the three little girls.
And sadly, what happened to your father?
My father was murdered, as all the rest of my family was. All my aunts, my uncles, from a family of close to 300 people. No one survived. In the ghetto, there were 150,000 Jews. Only 200 survived, and I am one of them. The ghetto of Lviv and the Janowska concentration camp next door, that was a slave labor camp, was everyone was exterminated. Everyone who lived beyond illnesses, sicknesses, and hunger was gassed and burned in the extermination camps.
How did you and your family make it to the United States?
We first made it to Lima, Peru. After the war, the American came and they had protected us a little bit, and they helped us in the DP camps. And the brother of my father, the eldest brother, who had been a doctor in Vienna, and in 1938 was told that according to the Nuremberg laws, he was not allowed to practice medicine. So he left Vienna, and Peru gave him a visa. And so he settled in Peru. He was a bachelor, and he found us after the war in Germany in one of the DP camps and asked my mother to come to Peru. And there he took care of us, educated us, eventually married my mother, and we had finally a wonderful family.
And you say DP camps, those are displaced persons.
Camps, yes.
There was a part of your story that was fascinating. Again, you're very young when all this is happening, that your mother, one of the ways she protected you is that basically was saying that you guys, you're Christians.
That's right. We learned how to be Catholic. And from the very beginning, when we arrived in Buchach, we started every Sunday to go to church. No one was allowed to know that we were Jews, because the Polish people would persecute us also, and they would tell the Germans that we were a Jewish family. So we were not allowed to know that we are Jewish. Slowly, I forgot being Jewish. And my world was a Catholic world, where I went to Sunday Mass. I had one dress, a white dress for church, and one pair of shoes for Sundays. And so I began to love this new religion, and I felt very comfortable in it. And till today, I have in my heart a little spot for my Jewish friends and my Jewish religion. I remember Christmases were so beautiful. So after I was told I am Jewish, I still wanted my Christmas tree. And my mother brought me one, and I had to promise that it was the last time.
Yeah, because so when you were children, I mean, at one point you just thought you were
right.
Catholics.
We were convinced. I was convinced. And so today, if a friend, a neighbor is dressing a Christmas tree, I offer to help always.
You know, I'm thinking about, I get the opportunity from time to time to talk with people like you who have lived through this horrible part of history, but it's fascinating because there's so many lessons that we can learn, that you tried, and you're still so active in trying to share these stories because you want especially young people to learn something.
Yes, I lecture at schools and the colleges and in many places. I also have taken on a program that is called the March of the Living, where we go, after I tell them the story, we go to Poland and we visit for 1 week all the places, the extermination camps, where 6 million of our brothers and sisters were murdered, of which 1.5 million were children. And these young seniors usually learn what I told them. They see it in person and they can connect to our past. Because if we do not look at our past, we may not have a future.
Rita Carl, a Holocaust survivor living in Aventura. Today is National Holocaust Remembrance Day. You can learn more about Anita's story at WLRN.org.
For you, you want to share these stories to pass on this wisdom in hoping that younger generations gain something and that none of that is lost. But what is it like for you in that you have to, because now you're talking about going back and reliving these memories.
Every time. For me, it is very difficult, but I do it from my heart in the hope that they will never forget me, nor they will forget my story. It's a story of heroism that my mother accomplished, where she had to choose to save the life of her husband or the lives of her three children. And they chose the life of the children so we can be witnesses to this blackest time in the story of humanity, not only of Judaism, but of humanity. Because when humanity forgets to be human and forgets compassion, then we are lost. We should never allow this to happen again. And that's why we must learn and remember it forever.
When you take these folks on the march, when you take them to Poland and you show them these places, typically, what do they say to you? What are some of the things they experience that they share with you?
First of all, it is unbelievable for them or anyone who goes to these camps and sees what happened and how it happened and the cruelty and evil that rained upon us. It is difficult to see the mountains of belongings that the Germans took away. The shoes of little children, they are still there. The Germans used our hair to make mattresses. They used our skin to make lamps. And they used our bones for fertilizers. So these crimes against humanity shall never be forgotten.
You know, we defeated the Nazis in World War II, but we find ourselves now in this very weird time where we see that symbol and we see the name Nazis, neo-Nazis is what they call themselves today. When you see that today, what do you think?
I think that they are ignorant people above everything else, because with a little bit of education and knowledge of why and how it happened, and if they only visited these places, they would think in another way. I am convinced that mainly it is ignorance.
How have your mother's actions, you talk about her heroism, how has that changed, or how did that impact, I should say, really as you were growing up, and the woman that you became, and now what you're doing with your life?
We were very, very proud, my sisters and I, of my mother always. We admired her and we cherished her. We knew she gave us life twice. And for us, she's the symbol of our people. She is a heroine of our people. Maybe a silent heroine, but yet, she is a heroine of our people. She saved 3 lives from the Holocaust.
What ways can people support the continuation of Jewish traditions and education around Holocaust? What can we do, these other generations, in helping?
The best help of all is to study and to educate oneself on the subject. And as we have, thank God, in Florida, studies on the Holocaust in every school. So by doing that, we shall not forget, and we will remember.
You brought something with you. This is a book about your mother.
Yes, my mother wrote the book when she was close to 80 years old. She decided to do that as a testimony for the children, for the three of us. And so she wrote this fabulous book called Escape to Life. It was written in Lima, so it is in Spanish, although it was translated into English, but yet unpublished. The book is about what we went through and about her history and the history of her family and my family. And it was edited 3 times in South America under great reviews, and it was sold out the 3 times. Today the book is sold out, but we are trying to publish it once more.
And, you know, did she write it specifically for you and your sisters?
Yes, she did. She was not a writer, but yet it is written with such heart and feeling that you cannot put it down. It is not a big book, and it was never intended to be what it became, a bestseller.
That was Anita Carl, a Holocaust survivor living in Aventura. We spoke with Carl back in April of 2018. She's continued her work with schools throughout COVID. In an email message, she said, quote, Zoom has been a lifesaver. Tonight, she's scheduled to speak at the Israeli embassy in Miami. And by the way, an update on that book, Escape to Life, written by her mother, Molly Carl, that has been translated again to English, published again. It is now available on Amazon. Find more of our coverage on National Holocaust Remembrance Day by going to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we are reading The Orchid Thief. Why are South Floridians so obsessed with this flower? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, again, for the month of January, we have been reading The Orchid Thief as the Sundial Book Club title. We recently spoke with two pairs of folks who had their take on the book and their take on the passion that people have for orchids. First, let's go to two Sundial listeners, Bilad Uribe, yes, one of the former hosts of WLRN, and Susan Edgar Lee, a retired teacher. We asked them what they thought about the book and how Susan Orlean unfolded this story of orchid obsession. And we started with Susan Edgar Lee.
I loved it. I actually have read a book, the other book that I know of by Susan Orlean is called The Library Book, and it came out maybe 2 years ago, and it was very successful, but I did not like that anywhere near as much as I loved this book. I don't know if it was the idea that, you know, it put me out there where the orchids were, but I mean, it was really the same format. You know, I could definitely compare the two books, but she just paints such a vivid word picture that, you know, I could really see it all. And that's what I loved about this book.
I have to say that living, I mean, I'm in LA, and that whole feeling of the, just the heat of Miami and the Florida area was so mesmerizing to me that I was transfixed. And I'm kind of glad that I haven't finished it because I'm really taking my time. Each chapter is like a little book in itself.
The people in her story are so obsessed with orchids. Do you understand why some people just kind of go crazy over this flower? Susan, what do you think? Do you have orchids, by the way?
I have orchids just in that I have a big enough yard to try and stick them places for reblooming. And so my family have given them to me. But I don't quite get the obsession. But I mean, she does a good job of explaining it. I mean, you know, that was some of my favorite parts was, you know, when she would talk about different people. So there's a Japanese businessman who gave up his whole career and all his possessions and moved with 2,000 orchids to Malaysia because both of his wives had said that they were being neglected due to the orchids. And he went, okay, I can do this then. So, it was just really interesting, the obsession angle. But no, I don't have it that bad.
I've had orchids, like Susan mentioned, have been given to me. I can't have them now because of my cat, who's sitting in front of the computer begging for attention. He'd probably eat them and then he'd be poisoned. But I think Susan Orlean made such a great description, the way she described the orchid hunters. And that to me was so fascinating. The story of, you know, how they brought them and they did absolutely anything to get them. And sometimes I thought that was so fast. What a fascinating piece of history. And I personally, I'm a plant killer. I'm a complete plant killer. So it makes sense that I wouldn't have plants in my house. But I love orchids. Orchids are so beautiful. And I can understand, after having read what I've read in the book and the way Susan describes it so eloquently, I can understand the obsession that people would, you know, that they would go to those limits.
The interesting character in the book is John LaRoche, which really launched this whole book. I mean, she finds this Miami Herald story about him and what he's trying to do. I don't know, have you ever met a guy like that? What did you think of the way she had told the story of this guy? What do you think about guys like that? It's a typical, I don't know, to me it just seemed like the typical Florida man, Susan.
Okay, Florida man is so enigmatic to me. So maybe this is going to help me understand Florida man better. But what I found was important about him was, oh my gosh, he was so intelligent. And he could do like anything. So he kept changing his obsessions, you know. And he'd move on to something else that doesn't seem that similar, but in the end, he was kind of building off of everything. So he had this background where he knew about cloning. And so once he got going with the orchids and the Seminole tribe, he said, hey, we can overcome the idea that, you know, we can't sell these because that would be illegal. Oh, we'll just clone this one that we're, you know, not really stealing. And then that is leading to all these other ones, which I'll call grocery store orchids. And that was kind of an eye-opener for me because, yeah, oh, okay, so this is why the ordinary person, you know, might be able to get a hold of enough orchids to satisfy themselves because of cloning. And so I really liked hearing about that part.
I like Susan, I was fascinated by his intelligence. And if we're talking about Florida men, I think that he would be kind of hard to date. It's sort of like an extended ADD. I mean, you know, you get obsessed with one subject and then you go off and you do something else. So he would be a great dinner party guest. I don't know what he would be like to live with, though.
That was Pilar Uribe and Susan Edgar Lee, two Sundial listeners, sharing their thoughts about the January book, The Orchid Thief. And if you'd like to be part of one of our discussions in the future, just join the book club on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. Now, let's hear from two orchid experts. We spoke with Jan Amador. She's the Flamingo Gardens Board President and President of the Flamingo Gardens Orchid Society. Also, Lucy Matos Lodato, the head of the Flamingo Gardens Orchid Tears Volunteer Group. One of the things I thought was so interesting reading this book, The Orchid Thief, is what lengths people will go to get their hands on an orchid. And I wondered if you guys had ever seen or heard of a situation like that where somebody tried to break into the gardens or maybe into your house or somebody's house, you know, to get an orchid. Lucy, you have? You've heard that?
I had an orchid stolen this past January right from in front of my house. It was on a hanging basket in the tree, and it was 11:30 at night. I didn't run out because I had like 103 fever. But I saw this woman step onto my property, and I thought she was just going to grab a flower. And the next morning, the orchid was gone. So, I was traumatized. I really was.
I can appreciate the beauty of orchids. I can appreciate nature from a distance, as I usually do. But I'm trying to understand the obsession people have with orchids. How do you describe it to someone like me? What is it that somebody's going to want to break into your, you know, onto your property to steal an orchid or go through a swamp just to see one? What's the obsession?
Well, they are really interesting, unique epiphytes, the most advanced plant that there is. And they are so different. You can, like, there is a never ending source of, oh, I've never seen that one. And I would like to have that one. And could I grow it? So, you know, you go to an orchid show and it really is like being in a candy store for people that love these things. They just, there's no, and it's just a beautiful hobby to see, you know, to grow a plant. First of all, most of them are very slow growing. So you got to be patient. And then if you buy an orchid in bloom, okay, fine, wonderful. And then you want to, the next time it blooms again, it's like this big accomplishment. You made it bloom again. Each plant, unless you have a division of a, you know, of an orchid, each plant is just individual. So the flowers may vary a little bit. It's great for hoarders because you, especially when you get to my situation, I have more orchids than I can take care of. But if I hear of an orchid show, I want to go. And even though my husband says, now you have enough, right? I said, yeah, no, I will only get something if it's absolutely that I don't have it and I've been waiting for it for years. And I always come home with orchids.
For a beginner, how do you advise people to start to appreciate orchids? Where do you begin?
I begin with, I tell everybody, do not buy a little tiny seedling because you're looking at 5 to 7 years to see a flower. You will not be successful. Invest in a nice size plant so you'll get the rewards of seeing that flower and take care of it. And that's the beauty of belonging to an orchid society because we help people learn how to take care of them. Just reading it out of a book is not so easy.
Lucy, what about you? What's the advice for a beginner?
I would say go visit Flamingo Gardens, of course, because you can see there orchids that we have tried to imitate nature and what you can do at home. You know, find a local vendor and make sure it's an orchid you can grow at home and get advice because the plant, the orchid that you're buying has been cared for by an expert. When you get at home, the conditions are so different. So you have to ask a lot of questions.
So you just heard from Lucy Matos Lodato and before that, Jan Amador, both of Flamingo Gardens. You can learn more about their orchid collection on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And again, head to the Sundial Book Club Facebook page to hear our interview with the author, Susan Orlean. By the way, don't forget that we are switching over into February soon, and we already have our book for February. It's Swamplandia by Karen Russell. That's our February title. So again, just go to the Facebook group, Sundial Book Club, ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. And let us know what you think of the book. And you can always post questions for the authors there. We can get those questions to the authors and see what they have to say. So again, Swamplandia by Karen Russell is the February title. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, January 27th. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Zaria Reimer is our intern. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Again, the theme music for the show is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Find them, gobalo.com.
Don't forget, also, you could find this program as a podcast on your podcast app. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, what does women's basketball look like during the pandemic? We're going to learn about the future for young women pursuing a career in the sport and how college teams are responding to this challenge. And in the latest in our series, Live from the 305, our interview with Jason Derulo, the pop star from Miramar, has built one of his largest followings on TikTok. And we're going to learn about his Haitian roots, his activism, and his musical inspirations. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. Remember, always go back and listen to any of our old shows, whether in podcast form or at WLRN. Just look up Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.